Good afternoon. The Human Services Committee will come to order. We have two bills to hear today. We're going to hear them in the order that they are listed. First, Senate Bill 180, second, Senate Bill 756. But we are going to open a public hearing briefly on Senate Bill 756 to allow Senator Bates to testify, and then we will close that public hearing and go into the hearing on Senate Bill 180. So we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 756. Would you like to talk about 756 very briefly?
Very briefly. Thank you, Senator. Very briefly, 756 does define prescription contraceptive. It requires health insurance coverage for contraceptive prescriptions when that same when prescription drug coverage is included in the plan. That's basically the run of the bill. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and fellow members of the committee. First, I want to thank you for allowing me to testify early and out of order. I know it's sort of disjointed to do that, but I have to get down to my district because we have a big event going on this week in the Shakespearean Festival opening up, and I have to leave right after this testimony. To a certain degree, as a male member of the species, I feel a little uncomfortable making this pitch, but I'm going to make it because I'm also a physician and I see this problem every day. And generally speaking, when I see patients, I'm perfectly capable of doing vasectomies, which I'll be doing one tomorrow morning. I send people to tubal ligations. But when it comes to contraceptive advice for women, some women can't get what they need because it's not covered by their insurance. And that's always struck me as totally ludicrous. It's been going on in my practice for 30 years. Recently, we've had court orders saying that is not the law of the land. And frankly, it's time for our state to move forward, as many other states have, and make this a mandate for insurance. There's no there's no information I've ever seen that this increases premiums. In fact, I think there's indications that it probably lowers premiums because of the high cost of birth. A woman's right to have contraception and to have it in a reasonable fashion from her insurer, I think, is one that's straightforward, and one of which I hope this committee will move quickly to the floor so we can take care of this as something I see that is vital for women in our state and is something that's appropriate for them to have as a choice. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Yes.
Senator Starr.
The purpose of this is to avoid unwanted pregnancies.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette and Senator Starr, contraceptives is used primarily to avoid pregnancies. It is not an abortion. It's not an abortive fact, and it causes a prevention of the pregnancy itself. Allows women to choose when they want to become pregnant and allows them to plan their families.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for allowing me to testify early. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 180, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 756.
On the way around.
I'm sorry, 180. I'm sorry. We close the public hearing on 756 and open the public hearing on 180. Very good. Okay, John Horton.
Chairman Morissette and distinguished members of the committee, first I'd like to thank you for allowing me to testify today. I first want to explain a little bit about who I am and why I'm here. For the record, my name is John Horton. I'm the Associate Deputy Director for State and Local Affairs in the Drug Policy Office of the White House. It's perhaps not typical for White House staff to testify before state legislators on a state bill. And so perhaps explaining exactly the rationale behind my visit, not only to Oregon, which happens to be my home state, and I'm always glad to get back, but also to some other states, such as North Dakota, Colorado, and other states I'll be visiting over the next few weeks. Just so you know, I'm not selecting Oregon for any particular reason. May be helpful. The Office of National Drug Control Policy is the arm of the White House that aims to reduce drug use in America. Every year since the office's creation in the late 80s, the President has released a national drug control strategy with the objective of reducing drug use in America. marijuana, methamphetamine, cocaine, etc. Under this president, when we started working for him in his first term, he made two things very clear with respect to America's drug problem. First, that he wanted those of us working on this issue to treat this as a nonpartisan issue. Those of you who know anybody who has faced addiction problems with cocaine, heroin, or any drug, know that addiction knows no political boundaries. And the second thing was that we would be accountable, both to him and to the American public, for making sure the drug use in America goes down. With that as the backdrop, I wanted to give a brief overview of where we stand in the United States with respect to illegal and illicit drug use, and then also to talk specifically about the issue of prescription drug abuse and how that relates to the bill before you, Senate Bill 180. The good news in America is that for the last 3 years, we have seen declines in teen drug use, which we consider to be the most important indicator of where we are and where we're going in the United States. In most categories, teen drug use is down about 18% for marijuana, 17% overall for all drugs, and also for cocaine, LSD, ecstasy, heroin, categories like that. Historically, when we have talked about the drug problem in America, we have focused on what I would call the traditional drugs, cocaine, marijuana, heroin, ecstasy, LSD, etc. But when we started looking at the data and the research and the studies that are available to tell us what is going on in America regarding the illegal and illicit use of drugs, we found a notable and a disturbing trend over the past couple of years. And that is that there is an emerging drug problem of prescription drug abuse in this country. In fact, it is now, and this may surprise some people, the number two drug problem in America behind only marijuana. It exceeds cocaine use. It exceeds heroin use. It exceeds ecstasy use. It exceeds methamphetamine use. I recognize that, and methamphetamine is one example, that there are different ways to measure exactly how to consider the threat of a drug. Methamphetamine obviously causes unique problems in communities, but when measured by the prevalence of the drug use, prescription drug abuse is the number one problem, number two drug problem in the country. For that reason, in both 2004 and also in 2005, Mr. Chairman, would you like me to continue or to wait?
We'll continue as a subcommittee. Everybody's gone except you and all of these people. So.
Okay. I hope I didn't say anything to drive them out of the room.
You must have said something.
Well, I will just resume where I left off. For the first time in 2004, the president's national drug control strategy focused not only on cocaine and heroin, but also on prescription drug abuse. And the president's 2005 drug control strategy was released yesterday. It also continues our commitment to reducing prescription drug abuse in America. And the analogy that I would draw is with methamphetamine. There are some states now in the United States, particularly on the eastern side of our country, that are facing methamphetamine for the first time. Oregon, I know, has faced this for a number of years, but it is a threat that has moved eastward and southward to some degree. They come to us and they say, why didn't anybody tell us about methamphetamine? We should have done something before it became more of a problem. The reason I draw that analogy is because we now know from the data and from the studies that are before you in my written testimony, which I would ask to have entered into the record, that prescription drug abuse over the last few years has been going up. And we believe that now is the time, not only in states like Oregon, but nationally, to try and address this before it becomes a bigger problem. The question, of course, is what to do about it. With respect to our approach for all illegal drugs, we view these as market-based phenomena. They are dictated by supply and demand. That is, of course, true for all legal markets, and it's also true for illegal drugs. But that requires knowing and understanding exactly how people that acquire prescription drugs illegally and illicitly get the drugs in the first place. I want to break aside here for a moment and emphasize that the position of the administration is, of course, that people who have prescription drugs pursuant to a doctor's prescription and also use the prescription drugs as prescribed should be allowed to do that. We support that. And, of course, we do not want to impede that process. That is an important part in our country of pain management and also of healing. So our policy objective has been to balance out these competing considerations of wanting to reduce prescription drug abuse without impeding legitimate medical practice. But back to the question of how people illicitly and illegally acquire prescription drugs when they abuse them, there are, of course, several ways. The Internet plays a role. There is some degree of theft from pharmacies. There is even a very small amount, but an existent amount, of actual dealing on the street. But one of the key ways that people get illicit prescription drugs is through what we call doctor shopping. And briefly, what that entails is I might or might not have a chronic pain condition, for example, but I might go to several different doctors, 5 or 6 or 10 different doctors, to get several prescriptions. Or I might take one prescription, copy it, go to several different pharmacists. But in either case, I am getting more of the controlled substance, more of the prescription drug than I'm entitled to and that I should have. And that, of course, puts a person at risk of addiction, injury, and sometimes, with some of the more serious drugs that can be abused, even death. So that's why we're taking this problem very seriously, not only prescription drug abuse, which is now, as I indicated earlier, the number two drug problem in America, but also doctor shopping itself. The act of doctor shopping relies on a break in communication between the physician, the prescriber, and the dispenser. What can fix this problem is what is called prescription drug monitoring programs or prescription drug reporting programs. As I mentioned, the President's 2005 drug control strategy was released yesterday, and it strongly supports the state's adoption of prescription drug reporting programs, which is why I'm here. We understand we can't do these sort of things at the federal level. So not only do we ask state legislators like yourselves to take a look at these programs and their effectiveness, but we also support them financially. The Hal Rogers Prescription Drug Monitoring Program grant, which is run through the Bureau of Justice Assistance, provides mechanisms for states to study, to implement, and then to upgrade and enhance their programs. I'm pleased to announce, which I'm not actually announcing it, this happened some time ago, but I'm pleased to report that Oregon is the recipient of a $350,000 implementation grant, which is the maximum amount of implementation grant that we provide, and that goes certainly far enough to implement these programs. There are several benefits from having these programs. The most obvious, of course, is that it cuts down on doctor shopping and therefore prescription drug abuse. But this is also an important mechanism for getting people who need help, people who need treatment, into treatment. The primary purpose of this, of course, is medical, to make sure that the disease of addiction does not spread. There are circumstances where law enforcement activity is, of course, warranted. There are some circumstances, I'm happy to say that they are not altogether too frequent, but where sometimes people acquire prescription drugs and then resell them. Prescription drug monitoring programs can provide information to doctors to make sure that their patient is not doctor shopping, and also to pharmacists to make sure that the individual who is coming to them to get the prescription is not doctor shopping and going to end up abusing the drug. That is why we support these programs, and I would encourage Oregon State Legislature to take a look at the implementation of this program, as I will be going to other states as well, encouraging states to take advantage of both the financial support that the federal government provides here, but also to take a look at the overall drug threat, which, as I indicated, prescription drug abuse has become a more significant one in this country. Before closing and taking questions, I also would like to note that last year in the President's drug control strategy, we highlighted Nevada's prescription drug monitoring program as a model program, and this year we highlight Idaho's program in the strategy. I'm also pleased that I'm accompanied today by the directors, the people that run both of these programs in Nevada and Idaho, and they will be able to answer questions about their program, why they believe these programs work, why they're effective, and why they're important to help reduce prescription drug abuse. With that, thank you again for allowing me to testify, and I'd be happy to take your questions regarding prescription drug monitoring programs.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Senator Cruz.
Does this bill mirror Idaho and Nevada?
I'm actually going to defer to the individuals from those states. I recall that it roughly does. I do think there are some differences.
Okay. Follow-up, Mr. Chair. And we appreciate that there are federal funds available for this. I think it's significant. How much additional money are we going to get to deal with the meth program problem in the state?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Cruz, as you know, it's a very tough budget environment this year, and that's going to, of course, ultimately depend not only, on what the House and the Senate back in Washington, D.C. do. There are some federal funds that we have requested in the federal 06 budget that relate to methamphetamine enforcement and cleanup. It is a cut. It is a cut from previous years, and we're going to have to work that out with the Congress, and I suppose I'll find out the answer to that question after Congress comes back.
Okay. Mr. Chair, just one more follow-up, just a suggestion. There are some locally funded law enforcement programs tied in. There's a fairly good list that I think are targeted for cutting, and those may be the most effective means we have of controlling that issue in the state. So if you could pass the word to somebody, they aren't big programs, they aren't huge amounts of money, but I think the effectiveness of local law enforcement, and in this state, particularly in the rural parts of the state, those federal funds are absolutely critical for the programs to be ongoing.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz, thank you. The HIDA program has run out of my office, and the reason it wasn't completely cut, but rather it is cut somewhat, but to $100 million is because we do believe that it is effective, and that if we put it at the Department of Justice, it can be even more effective by cooperating with other programs instead of overlapping. I share your praise for the HIDA program. I think it's been a very good program in a lot of ways, and I'll take that back with me.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Confidentiality is, I'm a nurse by trade, and confidentiality is really important to me. And for those who are, let's just take the case of pain management. And we have been physicians have been so nervous about giving adequate prescription for those who really do suffer pain. And I think we're getting better at that you do need to take care of these patients. I'd hate to have police going in saying, hey, you're getting too much. How do you deal with that issue in particular?
I think, Mr. Chairman and Senator Montes Anderson, you raise a very important point from a couple of perspectives. First of all, it is critically important that people who need pain medications for any kind of pain, chronic pain, are able to get that without anything, including a prescription drug monitoring program, impeding on that. And one of the reasons that we support these programs is because we don't see that legitimate process being impeded. I would refer to, with respect to the question regarding privacy, for example, the HIPAA requirements. While, as I recall, the prescription drug monitoring program itself is not a covered entity, most of the parties involved are going to be. And so as we have taken a look at these programs to determine whether or not there are valid privacy concerns, what we have come down to is first of all, the physician, of course, already, even without this program, knows what they are prescribing. And they ask the question of the patient, are you taking any of their prescriptions? Now, of course, a person who is doctor shopping may not tell the truth about that, but that is a legitimate object of information for the physician to seek. On the pharmacist side, the pharmacist, of course, knows the prescription that is being brought to them, and the only additional information that pharmacist is being provided is information that leads the pharmacist to confirm the accuracy of what is being provided to them. With respect to law enforcement, we do believe that giving law enforcement some degree, not completely unfettered, but some degree of access to the information is important, simply because both at the federal level and the state level, as we know, possession of a controlled substance, in this case, the bill refers to twos, threes, and fours, is not a legal activity. And with respect to prescription drugs, of course, that is the case unless you have a valid prescription and are using it and possessing it pursuant to that. But the real reason for that is not so that we give law enforcement the ability to go in and knock down doors and do things like that. That has not happened in America with respect to the amount of prescription drugs we're talking about, personal use amounts. What it does do is in the cases where there is determined, and this varies state by state, a proper role for law enforcement, what we support and what typically happens is the person is diverted into treatment. The people who have more serious problems who are doing this consistently may in fact come into law enforcement even without the prescription monitoring program, because they may engage in the act of forgery, they may engage in the act of theft. But again, the right thing there, we believe, is not necessarily to treat this as a situation where jail is going to be the remedy. If we treat this as a medical issue where there is an addiction problem and can get them into a drug court or some other treatment opportunity, that is going to be more effective at solving the problem. There is no doubt that it's an important continuing issue with every state with drug policy to balance how to treat the issue of possessing a controlled substance, whether it's cocaine, heroin, marijuana, or in this case a prescription drug, and every state will have to continue to do that. But again, we view this as something where law enforcement in those situations can help a person get treatment, not simply be engaged in punitive acts.
Follow up?
Yeah. Well, let's keep the answer brief because we have other people to hear. We have two mega bills to hear today.
So. Certainly, Mr. Chairman.
I'll wait because my questions may be answered later on, so I'll defer.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So, Gary, would you come up, please, and Richard Markson and Keith McDonald, would you please come up? And we will hear from Nevada and Idaho, as well as Oregon. So, Gary, you can go ahead and start off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me just a minute, yeah. We're going to try to get to the other bill also. We're not going to have a work session on this bill. There are a couple of other people who we will hear who have some opposing views. And then those of you who we're going to have another public hearing later before we pass this bill. So we're not going to try to do it all today. And then we're going to try to move to the other bill and see if we can get through that, which we might not. But we'll give it our best shot.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate this as an informational hearing. And I hope you'll bear with me while I read through a few of my notes. I'm Gary Schnabel. I'm Executive Director for the Oregon State Board of Pharmacy. It's important that I get this to you in as organized a manner as I can because there's a fair amount of misunderstanding, and I think that I can do this in less than 10 minutes if I read it. I don't know how long it would take if I just start talking. I have submitted copies of the board's written statement that you have. It provides background and rationale for Senate Bill 180, and my comments here will be short and summary in nature, be complement to the written testimony. For the past 6 months, the Board of Pharmacy has hosted a coalition of interested stakeholders to review Senate Bill 180 and try to develop some consensus among the prescribers and dispensers. The coalition included doctors, pharmacists, dentists, nurse practitioners, and naturopaths, and representatives of their respective regulatory boards and associations. Issues were discussed in detail, and the bill's language was adjusted through this process. And some of the participants from the stakeholders group are here today to provide their perspective to the committee. While not all agreed on the exact language of the bill, there was general agreement that prescription controlled substance diversion at the retail pharmacy and community medical clinic level is an increasing problem. There was recognition that states across the country today are planning, establishing, and operating new and existing prescription monitoring programs to interrupt the cycle of prescription drug abuse and diversion. And I provided you with a map that shows what states across the country are doing. I'd like to look at that in a minute. At the coalition, there was consensus that some concerns exist about the new program and how it would work. And there was consensus that a balance must be achieved between the regulatory need to limit the illegitimate and illegal use of controlled substance, abuse of controlled substances, and the medical necessity of legitimate and effective use of controlled substances for pain management. To give you a sense for what other states are doing, the map shows that, if you have it, there are states that are colored in maroon are the states that have active programs. There's a color key on the bottom of the states. Also yellow and red that have introduced legislation or that have that are considering legislation that has not been approved yet. or submitted yet, and the white states aren't doing anything. I left Oregon uncolored there to show the contrast with the other surrounding states that have active programs. Senate Bill 180 is not a bill only for the Board of Pharmacy or for the pharmacists. While the Board of Pharmacy has taken the lead to research and draft the bill and has secured a federal grant for $350,000 to plan and implement the program is designed to address a problem that is experienced not only by every pharmacist working behind the retail counter, but also by every practitioner who prescribes controlled substances and every patient and family caught up in the cycle of drug abuse, drug diversion, and addiction. Prescribing practitioners are aware of the ever-present risk of being scammed by a drug-seeking individual, and pharmacists must always be vigilant at the pharmacy counter for altered, forged, or phony prescriptions. Whether these doctor shoppers are seeking drugs they need for untreated pain or whether they're seeking drugs for recreation or addiction, there is no debate that drug-seeking, doctor shopping, and prescription drug diversion is occurring with alarming frequency. Mr. Chair, with that background, I'd like to briefly summarize the bill to provide an overview, and then I'd be happy to answer questions. Senate Bill 180 is a drug abuse prevention and early intervention effort. The bill creates a mechanism by which the controlled substance prescription dispensing data from each pharmacy in the state are reported to the Board of Pharmacy into an electronic repository. This information, which is the same information that now exists separately in each pharmacy in the state, could then be made available through this repository to practitioners and pharmacists for the purpose of identifying patient use. The centrally stored dispensing data can be used by practitioners and pharmacists to identify patients or others who are inappropriately seeking controlled substance prescriptions and make more informed decisions about their ongoing treatment and disposition. Information from the repository could also identify or prevent the rare event of a prescriber or a pharmacist inappropriately prescribing or dispensing controlled substances for non-medical purposes and could alert the appropriate regulatory board for intervention. Section 1 of the bill simply provides applicable definitions. Section 2 establishes reporting program and authorizes the Board of Pharmacy to write rules for administration of the program. Section 3 requires pharmacies to report, defines how information can be used, provides civil immunity for good faith use of the data, and declares that the data may not be used as evidence in civil or criminal proceedings. Section 4 authorizes the Board of Pharmacy to receive grants or other monies for the program. Section 5 establishes an advisory task force. Section 6 sunsets the advisory task force in January of 2012. There's a typo here. It says 2002. That should be 2012. And Section 7 declares an emergency, so the bill would take effect on passage. We have asked the committee to consider an amendment that relieves the governor of the responsibility for appointing members to the advisory task force and allows the Board of Pharmacy to make those appointments from nominees from the stakeholder groups. In the interest of brevity, I will conclude by referring to several supporting documents and ask that these be included into the hearing record. There is a March 2003 Portland Tribune article. This describes an individual in Portland who was making his living by illegally obtaining prescription drugs such as Xanax from various doctors and selling the pills at Pioneer Courthouse Square. There is a May 2003 GAO report titled State Monitoring Programs. Prescription drugs, state monitoring programs provide useful tool to reduce drug diversion.
That's your word.
There is a Journal of Law, Medicine, and Ethics article written by David Brushwood, who's a professor of pharmacy and law at the University of Florida, Symposium, Improving the Treatment of Pain, Legal, Regulatory, and Research Perspectives. There is a copy of a resolution from a meeting of the National Association of Attorneys General in March of 2003, a statement of the American Medical Association to the Committee on Energy and Commerce, U.S. House of Representatives, regarding prescription drug monitoring, strategies to promote treatment and deter prescription drug abuse, And finally, an article from the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management, August 2004, a reassessment of trends in the medical use and abuse of opioid analgesics and implications for diversion control, 1972 to 2002. For the purpose of providing further background and supporting documentation, I would ask that these be included in the hearing record. And this concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Questions? Would you like to introduce
me? Yes, Chairman Morissette. I'm Keith McDonald with the Nevada State Board of Pharmacy. Okay. I've been their executive secretary for 16 years, and we initiated a prescription monitoring program in the state of Nevada for the purposes of trying to get a handle on the problems that have been described by John Horton as well as Gary Snobel. Emergency room doctors, pharmacists, all types of people, nurses and others recognize that if they worked in two different places, they'd see the same patients obtaining drugs. And so that abuse became prominent to us when we wondered what to do. Several states, and these programs go back to the 1940s, I might add, when California initiated their program, Hawaii early in the 40s, the state of Idaho in the 60s. These programs aren't new, but they always used paper systems, which were intrusive and difficult. So we devised the idea that we'd do a monitoring program that was electronic and that there wouldn't be paper floating around, and thus the potential for a lot of activity that might be intrusive to the practitioners and intrusive to patients if those papers got loose. So we approached our legislators, just as Gary is approaching you, and we addressed the public policy concerns that we thought were important for such a program. First, that it be transparent, that there wouldn't be any paper, there wouldn't be people's names floating around, there wouldn't be a list, there wouldn't be a database that anyone could approach and find information, and that the information would be given to doctors, patients, and pharmacies, principally. There's others that can be, and if you look at the legislation in our bill, you'll see that. Another public policy concern was not to infringe on patient care. Today, pain is considered the fifth vital sign, and it's very important that indeed patients are taken care of. When we initiated our program, we heard many times about the potential chilling effect on pain management and chilling effect on people to obtain drugs. I've presented a document or group of documents to you. Now, on the second page, there's a statistic page that will show the state's population, the number of Schedule II prescriptions, number Schedule III prescriptions, Schedule IV prescriptions, and you will see that the total prescriptions issued in Nevada have increased over the 8 years of this program per person in the state. So it's not a chilling effect whatsoever. In fact, it's been beneficial to doctors, and I'll explain that a little later. The next thing is a public policy concern was to have strict confidentiality, and I think others of you share that concern, and we did also. There's a document in there from our general counsel that said these programs are legitimate under the HIPAA Act. And he also said if interpretive decisions come down the pike later on, that he would advise us to the contrary. We passed this his document to our attorney general, and the attorney general says, I don't have to write an additional opinion. This will serve, and if there are HIPAA violations, we'll advise you. We have found none at this point. The ACLU came to us and said, this is very intrusive. And indeed, it wasn't intrusive. In fact, the ACLU, and I'd like to mention the man's name in Reno, Nevada, was approached by people, and he said, the program does not involve the destruction of patient confidentiality. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in the necessity to have an independent, secure database that other people can approach. And I think it was mentioned here about criminal justice people looking in on such a program. Indeed, we've had criminal justice agencies that thought they could approach the program and find out about people obtaining prescriptions. It's not the case. For a law enforcement agency to be able to obtain drug data, they have to have an active investigative case, and there has to be probable cause that the drugs were part of that active investigative case. Those are filtered through an individual in our Department of Public Safety. In addition, all other persons that want to obtain information other than the patient, the doctor, or pharmacy have to have a court order. If it's not a state agency, those other provided in the law. So we treat the patient information and the doctor information as well as the pharmacy information with strict confidentiality. Have there been breaches? There's been a couple, two in 8 years, and that's when people who received the information chose to give the information illicitly to some other people. It's not the fault of the program, but it's the fault of others. Another major public policy concern was to identify inappropriate use, the very topic that Gary Schnabel's been talking about, that John Horton was talking about. How would we approach that? We decided to use two devices. One, we'd use what was considered an unsolicited report. That is when people reached a level of utilization that was too excessive to even consider good health care, we would advise doctors and pharmacies. And those unsolicited reports, we decided to have a threshold. When we first thought of the threshold, if a person goes to five doctors, five pharmacies, and received over 300 dosage units within a short period, we would address that by sending a record to the doctors and pharmacies. When we first looked at that, in Nevada, which only had a population then of 1,700,000 people, we found there were close to 15,000 people that were going to more than five doctors and pharmacies. In Nevada, not in Oregon, but in Nevada, it happens to be a criminal act to go doctor shopping or doctor hopping and obtain controlled substances from multiple practitioners. If we put those people in prison, or even through the criminal justice system, it would double the prison population in Nevada. We knew right away that wasn't going to be an answer for us. So we didn't look at the criminal intervention concept at all, because it would cost the state, and as you're all aware, with tax dollars, you couldn't do such a thing, nor would you want to, because it doesn't solve the problem. We raised the threshold to 10 doctors, 10 pharmacies, and over 500 oral dosage units in 60 days. And we had 5,000 people doing that. Now, if you're worried about DUIs going down the highway and you're worried about people drinking and driving, think about how many people are on your roads, and I would guess your population in Nevada, Oregon, around 4 million people, I'd say you got 7 or 8,000 people driving under the influence of drugs on your highway. I'm just guessing, but I wouldn't be surprised. So we had these unsolicited reports we give, and when we started providing those to the doctors, they became very interested in the information we have. And on the chart that I've given you, the second page, you'll see near the bottom, reports requested. Doctors begin to ask, well, where can I get this information? In the first year, 1997, 480 reports were requested from doctors. Today, in 2004, we give doctors over 20,000 reports of people whom they suspect may be getting drugs inappropriately. Many of them aren't, but they present at the doctor's office with a type of presentation that looks like they may be drug abusers. The doctors really like this program and have ensured themselves of treating patients appropriately. You'll see underneath these documents I've given you, the State Medical Association supports the program, the State Board of Medical Examiners support the program, the president of the state, Nevada State Medical Association, has written a letter in support of the program, and I invite you to contact these persons or people that's in their chair today. I think there'd be a revolt if we took the program away because doctors use it so frequently. The important part is that doctors ask us before they see a patient, particularly pain management doctors. They come and ask us for a report so they can see if the patient they're going to be treating in the next day or so is indeed a person who is not abusing drugs. Another public policy concern was the ability to obtain statistical data. I don't know if Ritalin was ever a problem in the state of Oregon, if methadone deaths have occurred here in increasing number. I suspect they have. They certainly have in Nevada. oxycodone was a famous drug of abuse, and there was a lot of even books written about painkiller and other books written about the drug OxyContin or oxycodone. Indeed, how many are used in the state? You don't know. So our program with the public policy concern was the ability to collect that data and provide it to people. It's redacted data from patient and doctor names, but we do give it to the people. We also address intervention and enforcement issues. The cost of sending someone to a drug treatment program is between $4,000 and $7,000 a month. The cost of arresting someone and putting them in jail is between $25,000 and $35,000. Which is the better public policy? We decided to intervene, not to put people in jail. We believe that there should be a constituent inclusive active participants in the program. That is, the program should have pain management doctors on the advisory board. They should have all the associations and all the regulatory boards. We felt it was a public policy that everybody participate in this program to make sure it reaches the goals that the program should reach and not interfere with pain management. To you legislators who are wondering about cost, Chairman Morissette, to Senator Cruz, I know that immediately you talked about the grants. Our cost was between 5 and 7 cents for a reported prescription. And the program in Nevada, keeping in mind it's a smaller state, has been $150,000 or less for the first 6 years. I don't have data from 2003 to 2004 because we've had a lot of enhancements and we received grants from the Rogers grants, and so I don't have complete data. Those costs are up because we've had an enhancement program I'll just mention briefly, but be quick. Some realistic outcomes you need to understand. There is no chilling effect on prescribing. Our data shows that, in fact, good prescribing is increased. Secondly, the doctors like the ability to find the information and help stop inappropriate drug use. It does not stop drug abuse. Drug abuse is going to go on because we're a culture of drugs. You just have to watch the 6 o'clock news, and if you don't see 4 or 5 drug ads, albeit not controlled substances, we're convinced that we have to have a pill for everything, and American drug use continues to escalate. This program has been a benefit to practitioners and agencies and others in a way that I think we'd have a revolt if it was recalled. I wanted to say that we did one enhancement, and then I'll close. That enhancement was to, under the Hal Rogers grants, to hire an intervention officer. And of the worst people that we could find from our data over a period of 5 years, and again, people say this is intrusive. It's intrusive to save their lives rather than let them die from drug abuse. There's two people. There are people that quit drug abuse and those that die from it. There's not any other choice. And we have an intervention officer that goes out and talks to the people, tells them what they're doing, asks them to come there with their attorneys, their doctors, their preachers, their family members, and says, here's how we can help you. And we give them intervention practitioners. We give them addictionologist names. They may have pseudo-addiction where they think they're in pain and need better care. We recommend them to those doctors, and it's been a real benefit in the state. We have not had a negative effect from having this program in the state of Nevada. I'd be happy to talk to you with any questions you might have and try to answer them, and invite you to contact the people in Nevada. And if you'd like more information, my card's on the back, and I'd be happy to have you talk to the pain management doctors and others that use the program.
Let's go to Rex, and then we can have some questions.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, first off, I'd like to thank you for having us in for this hearing. We've been contacted by a number of our neighboring states. I'm Richard Mick Markison, Director of the Idaho State Board of Pharmacy.
Okay, thank you.
We've been contacted by a number of our neighboring states that have looked at our program, reviewed it, and are contemplating doing the same program that Oregon is thinking about. So, Montana, we have had discussions with them. We did with Wyoming, who now has a program. Wyoming was in our office 2 weeks ago and spending 2 days. So this is a trend that's coming down across the country. Our program is similar to Nevada's. We initiated this particular program in 1997. That's when we started it. But we had a program initially starting in 1967 where we used triplicate prescription blanks for Schedule IIs, later to duplicates, then into this program. And I won't go into how those programs worked, but this program is much more comprehensive and covers Schedules 2, 3, and 4. What I'd like to do with you today is give you some overview here, some graphs, some things that kind of give you a little bit of oversight of how these programs work. Nevada's and ours are pretty much the same, as I mentioned before. We go back 3 years with this data. We've just updated some of this information. If you look at 2002, you'll notice that the prescriptions reported in those three schedules was nearly 1,400,000. 2003, we were up to 1,459,000. 2004, we're up to 1,700,000. I think this is pretty graphic information that shows there has not been a chilling effect on the writing of these prescriptions. We have 490.
A question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And reporting those, that's all prescriptions.
These are all prescriptions for just Schedules 2, 3, and 4 that's in our program.
Controlled. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Good question.
These are the facilities that report to us. Our population is, of course, smaller than Oregon and Nevada's. We have 409 reporting facilities. That includes community pharmacies. And we also capture information from mail service pharmacies. This is Profiles Request, and you'll see how this information has gained popularity with our practitioners. If you look at 2001, you'll notice that we topped out at a little over 200 requests per month in 2001. 2002, we were up to a little over 400. 2003, we were up over 600. In 2004, we're at 800, and this is where we started so far in 2005. So you can see the popularity of this program with our practitioners requesting information on their patients. Requests from practitioners, law enforcement, other state agencies, mostly Medicaid uses our program, and then, of course, the pharmacies. This is information on the information that we've sent out in 5+ practitioners that patients are seeing. It fluctuates throughout the year. If that's continued to be that way since we started the program. This is in 2005. This is the number of patients at this time seeing 5+ practitioners. This is the schedule that we're covering. You'll see a pattern here that's very interesting. In 2002, about 14% of the prescriptions written were for Schedule 2. When we prescription program.
I think for the committee, it would be nice to just briefly say which drugs are Schedule 2, Schedule 3, Schedule 4.
There's actually 5 schedules set federally, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Schedule 1 has no medical use. That's your PCP, your crack, methamphetamine, and these kind of drugs, LSD. Yeah, so they have no medical use.
Marijuana is,
and marijuana is medical, in that also, medical, and that's Schedule 1.
Okay, we do have a medical marijuana law.
So anyway, that's Schedule 1.
I know it is, but you mentioned that Schedule 1 has no medical use. I just wanted to...
In Oregon.
Well, maybe California.
Yeah, maybe California.
That's a later bill.
I stand corrected in the state I'm in, and I'm sorry. I am here in the legislature so much, it's kind of a breath of fresh air to come here. Anyway. When we
Schedule 2 is?
Schedule 2s are the most addictive and potential for abuse. And then on down to Schedules 2, 3, 4, and 5.
You want me?
Well,
give us an idea of a drug or two.
Okay, in
schedule.
Schedule 2 would be OxyContin, methadone, methylphenidate, or Ritalin.
Okay.
Schedule 3 would be your Vicodin combinations. The Schedule 4 are non-narcotics like your benzodiazepines, Valium, and those types of drugs, and tranquilizers. And also, so when we finished with the schedule, the duplicate prescriptions, where we were tracking just Schedule 2s, we were tracking about 100,000 Schedule 2s a year. We figured at that time that about 10% of the prescriptions filled were for controlled substances were Schedule 2. So we thought at that time we would probably be monitoring somewhere around 1 million prescriptions. So in 2002, looking at Schedule 2, about 14% were being written, and there was about equal amount of Schedule 3 and 4 being written, and that was a trend in 2002. In 2003, you see a little increase in Schedule 2s, but you see a definite change in 3s and 4s, 3s being the written the most. So again, we're not seeing a chilling effect from this program. 2004, a little 1% more in Schedule 2, and again, a little wider range in 3s and 4s. And then this program also allows us to track drug trends. So you can, if you have a particular problem you think in a particular drug, you can look at this program and track those trends and how much is being used. And if you look at 2001 and you look at OxyContin in the 20 milligram range, you'll see the use right here. In 2002, it went up somewhat. 2003 was up a little more. 2004, again, it's quite a bit higher. So this program also allows us to track the trends of drugs being written for. And this is Schedule 2. This is your hydrocodone, the Vicodin. These are our most popular Schedule 3 drugs being written. Again, you can see the trend changes for these particular drugs. An increase, of course. Norco is another combination like Vicodin. Dextrine, Ritalin, Adderall, and of course Ritalin is methylphenidate. A number of years ago we were in the top 5 in the United States per capita use of methylphenidate. And in those years the legislature kept requesting the Board of Pharmacy to tell them how much we were really using. At that time we could not do that trend analysis, and today we can. Today I'm happy to say we're in the 30-some range and not the top 5 in the country.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Do you have these broken down by age or sex or at all, or is this just strictly by prescription? Do you track any of those demographics?
Mr. Chairman, no, Senator Anderson.
Okay. Thank you.
Methadone, that was mentioned earlier. Again, you can see the increase in the use of that particular drug. And that, again, is a Schedule 2. So you can follow these trends. This just gives you an idea the breadth of this program and what it can do for your state. Again, you see an increase in this particular drug. Here's our program cost at this particular time. This is our employee costs per year, this is our maintenance, and this is our miscellaneous cost. This cost includes all three people involved in that department, our chief investigator for controlled substances, and the two people that work with him in the program. So, which is, this cost is completely borne by the Board of Pharmacy. When the program was started, we initiated it, and paid for the cost of the program to begin with. There's never been any other monies for the board to put this program in place or to operate it. Until last year, we did get a grant from the DEA, and all the information now that's garnered from the pharmacies is sent directly to the board. So now we have an in-house program. We did get a trade-off from that because our contractor we have eliminated, and that money pretty much paid for the extra person we put on board. So we have three people involved in this program, We're the only agency involved in the program, and we run the program. The number of practitioners using the program has increased, like I indicated. They love the program. The program is not to be punitive. The program is to give the practitioner a chance to approach a patient when he understands through this program that there's probability that they're out there doctor shopping, going to other practitioners, gives that practitioner a chance to approach that patient, indicate to him that you're, or her, that you're probably getting in trouble with these drugs. We need to sit down and discuss that. I've heard from other states that don't have programs that when a physician has that suspect, they just kick the patient out of their office, out of their program. They don't want to see him anymore. This gives them a chance to really determine what that patient is doing. Are they doctor shopping? Which practitioners are they going to? And why are they doing this? So it gives that practitioner a chance to approach this patient and maybe get them out of trouble. We're trying to save these people, not incarcerate them. So I think that's a really important part of this program. The other thing it does, when these practitioners approach these patients, especially the pain specialists, these folks are dealing with chronic pain patients, not cancer pain patients in particular, who there may not be a problem with because there is a particular disease state that may end their life. But the chronic pain patient that's going to be with them for several years, they need a comfort zone and want a comfort zone with these patients. This gives them a chance to be able to determine that they're not seeing a lot of other practitioners, that they're following the contract that they have with them, and they're treating them without reluctance. They're not kicking them out of their practices. They're being able to maintain them, and they have a real assurance that these patients are doing what they're asking them to do with this treatment. This program is used by all kinds of practitioners, the physicians, the pain doctors, the dentists, nurse practitioners, physician's assistants. So a wide range of practitioners, and every one of them uses this information. The way they receive this information, if they have a concern, they call our office. They say, we have a concern with this particular patient. We fax them a request for information, so we're assured that that's who's requesting the information. That request comes back to us in writing, signed by that practitioner, and within 2 hours, that practitioner has the information on that patient, which gives them information on all the practitioners they have been to, the pharmacies they have been to, the drugs that have been prescribed, the strengths that have been prescribed, and the amounts. So they have a full profile on that particular patient.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Any other questions?
Yeah. Questions for Mr. Spowell.
Yes. Senator Metzger.
This relates to the bill, okay? If you could help me a little bit, I got a few things that I'm confused about. Page 1, Section 2, lines 25 and 26. If adding drugs other than controlled substances to the reporting requirements of Section 3 of this 2005 Act when deemed necessary by the board. So what you're saying is you want the authority to actually put anything on there. That's what you're saying, isn't it?
Chair, Senator Metzger, yeah, that's correct. There have been instances where there was request for the Board of Pharmacy to put a drug into a controlled substance schedule or move it from one schedule to another or to make a drug a prescription drug because there was a sense that it was being abused or that it was being used inappropriately. In fact, the Board has done that several times. One example is with ephedrine. One example is with parasulfurdol, Soma. Another example is butorphanol, Stadol nasal spray. And the board took action on those with what information they could find. But a program like this would allow the board to put that specific drug into that reporting system and actually gather data on how it was being used. So what, they could make a decision whether to take action on it or not. That was the purpose of it.
Okay. Well, I red flag that because that's a concern of mine to say that any drugs, even non-controlled drugs of any kind, for Section 3, this whole database and information that you can then give it to other folks, and totally up to your discretion, even though they're not controlled drugs. I mean, I'd like to think you'd use that judiciously, but that is very broad power. So, Mr. Chair, that's one concern I have. If I could make another follow. On page 2, in section 3, and I wanted to help kind of juxtapose these to me. You've got in lines 18 through 23, in terms of disclosing data, and you can do it to a valid court order, to a federal, state, or law, local law enforcement agency. So law enforcement agency, we're always talking about someone's pursuing some type of, you know, criminal action or maybe civil action, but law enforcement is not likely to be criminal action. And then C, to a health professional board for investigation purposes, because there obviously has some issues and they're concerned about licensure renewal. So this is an investigation. And yet, you go down to lines 36 and 37, and I don't see the relationship here. It says reports from the database established in Section 2 of this Act may not be used as evidence in any criminal or civil proceeding. So you're saying, we'll let you have access, Mr. Law Enforcement, to your investigation. And by the way, you can't use it in anything. Well, so first of all, I'm saying, well, why would law enforcement want to have access to find something that might lead them to a conclusion there's some violation of law or action, and yet they're restricted from using that? And if they're going to be restricted from using it, then why should they have the authority to look at it in the first place? So those are things that, you know, that I have real concerns about, other than for the purposes of harassment. For law enforcement, we know we can't use this, but we're just going to make your life as miserable as possible and look into this. And they say, gee, we found some stuff. It's linked to other things we've been investigating, but the law doesn't allow us to use it. So what's the purpose of those what appear to me to be conflicting parts of that section?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, the purpose of this is not to make people's lives miserable. I don't know if we said anything that we do believe that. But
well, it's not what you said. It's what's in the law that you're proposing.
And I can tell you, with regard to your first question, Idaho has some experience with that, and maybe they could respond to that. With regard to the second question, I can give you the rationale of why this is in there. This database doesn't create any new information. This is information that currently sits in the pharmacy computer around the state. So this repository would simply be copies of that information. So this is just a copy of something, of a source document. So a law enforcement agency with a court order could look at this in terms of their investigation or to further their investigation, but if they want to use it as evidence, they'd have to go find the source document. So this, it's not new information that should be used as evidence. It represents a source document somewhere that could ultimately be evidence. That was the rationale for putting that in.
Okay. I'm sure we'll get more testimony on that from legal-type folks, but it seems to me it could be problematic, that's all.
I guess I have a concern, and I don't know if maybe this is a federal issue. Oregon has a death of dignity law, and the feds don't recognize it, and the feds are taking this to the Supreme Court, and this is going to be a perfect tracking system, I guess, for doctors who under Oregon law can prescribe drugs that they think are in accordance with the law. And so I'm a little bit concerned about that. I don't know what point you could list that. I guess if you felt that there were doctors violating federal law, yet it was legal in Oregon, I don't know if you would list it. I see no reason to, but if the feds saw this as an opportunity to track that aspect, that raises some interesting questions. Now, we also have a medical marijuana bill in the state of Oregon, which we're going to be dealing with at another time, but the efficacy or the effectiveness of medical marijuana is something that will be part of, I hope, of the findings of that bill, so that we do establish it as something that does have some merit. But anyway, that I guess there are things about this bill that I am interested in hearing, and I'm sure
I could briefly respond to both of those if you want, with regards to John Ashcroft or with regard to the DEA looking at physicians who might be prescribing for the Death with Dignity Act. You use the word tracking, and I think that might be a key concept. Nobody can come to this program and say, let me see a list of all your doctors who are prescribing Second Off. can't be done. We couldn't give them that.
Okay.
Unless they came down with a federal hammer and beat up the Attorney General. I mean, and the Attorney General has already shown that he's going to defend the law. Okay. And the Board of Pharmacy, you know, we'll uphold the law. We don't have an opinion. It's law.
Okay.
So in terms of tracking, nobody could come and look at that group. In terms of an investigation of an individual practitioner, I don't think this program has anything to do with it, because that practitioner is not making any, it's not any secret. If they participated, they participated.
And that's not something people would shop, right?
Right, right. And this program tracks any controlled substances that was dispensed by a pharmacy. So if that prescription was filled by a pharmacy, it would be reported, and it would sit in the database, but nobody could come and say, let me see that list.
Okay.
With regard to medical marijuana, again, this is dealing with prescription drugs that have been dispensed from a pharmacy, and the medical marijuana doesn't come through a pharmacy, so there wouldn't be any information about that.
Okay. Good. Yes.
The point you brought up was very good, Senator Morissette. And it brought up another question. And again, when we get some legal types, mm-hmm. it'd be interesting to see that analysis. Because your point was very good about the assisted suicide, but I was looking at this same section on section lines 36-37, where it says it can't be used in any civil or criminal proceeding. Well, that's state law. We don't govern federal law. We can't tell the federal courts what to do. So, and yet we're allowing federal officials to look at the database. But we can't tell them they can't use it in a criminal or civil thing, no matter what we say in statute, because they're federal law. I just think that's, I'd like to hear legal analysis of that. I appreciate your response from the pharmaceutical side, but I really would like to hear at some point when we get further on this to get some legal analysis of whether these fears are valid or not.
Yeah, and I guess I thank you very much. That's a good point. This is maybe a side issue, but the medical marijuana, I would like to have a study done to decide whether or not marijuana is a legitimate drug at some point and have it dispensed through pharmacies in pill form or whatever. And then at that point, you would be tracking it, I imagine.
Sure, that's correct. If it was going to be dispensed in a pharmacy.
Okay. Yeah, but what you're telling me, though, is there is no recognition of marijuana as a legitimate pain drug. It's anecdotal, but not proven. Is that what you're saying? There's no.
That's correct. The federal schedule and the state schedule of controlled substance does list marijuana in that schedule. So it's unrelated to the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, where the Oregon Marijuana Act doesn't allow physicians to prescribe it for a medical use either. It allows the physician to recommend that the patient use it.
Okay.
But they're not writing a prescription, and there is no dispensing record. There's no dispensing of the product. It's simply used regardless of the federal schedule of controlled substances.
Right.
Chairman Morissette, I'll give you a view. Every drug that gets characterized in these programs has to have a national drug code. That's the way the data is collected.
Oh, okay.
Marijuana doesn't have one, so it wouldn't be collected.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
On that issue, is Marinol, what is that on the schedule?
Okay.
Two?
Yeah. Correct.
So there is a form of THC that is available mm-hmm. under prescription.
Okay. Okay. Good. Thank you. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. Kathy Hahn, would you come up, please?
Just a word on that. We'll take that later. Call her. Say a
You are our last witness, so thank you.
Mr. Chair and the distinguished senators of the committee, my name is Kathy Hahn. And I am chair of the Oregon Pain Commission.
Okay.
We have discussed this bill at length, both with Gary Schnabel at our meetings and without. And I would say that everyone on the commission is very interested in having the tools that this bill gives us. However, we have some serious reservations that we make sure if we are bringing this bill into Oregon, that it does not create problems for us. One of the things that the Pain Commission is charged to do is to look at barriers to treating pain patients and report them to the legislature. And we take that charge very seriously. We look at, and I've appreciated the discussion today because it seems that we are beginning to get some idea of studies of what's going on in other states and if there is a chilling effect, and it seems that perhaps maybe we're seeing that, that there isn't. We have a big problem with perception both in the commission and throughout the state so far that this could be a chilling effect. So we're going to have to deal with that if we do bring this law into pass this law. I think what the commission wants to do at this point, we did vote that we were not interested in seeing something like this the way it was written. I believe that the commission would be very interested in working with the Board of Pharmacy in at least if the commission was allowed to be on the task force so that we could represent our concerns. We also represent, my position on the commission is patient advocate, and I'm very concerned to make sure that the many, many pain patients who are out there, you know, throughout the country, we now have estimates that there are 100 million people who have chronic pain, and that's many, many more. Then the problem is pretty much an epidemic, much more so than drug abuse. But all of us are very much wanting to deal with drug abuse, but we want this to be a balanced process. So I guess what I'm asking is that the Pain Commission be a part of this process of figuring out if this is going to be a good bill.
Senator Cruz.
And I recognize your concern, but being a member of the Pain Task Force way back when we did that, one of the big hurdles we had to attempt to overcome at that point in time was the fear doctors had of BME. And we're overcoming that. So all things can be overcome. Your idea of being on the task force, I think, is a laudable one. I think it's very laudable. When Senator Metzger was talking about the Board of Pharmacy acting independently on all these things, I'm wondering if we might want to look at the task force having oversight over that on the front end, not just the back end, and that might help alleviate some of those concerns. So I think those are things that we should talk about in this. I think an advocate for patients would be a good inclusion on this.
Yes, I agree. There are a number of people who have signed up that we were not going to hear because we are going to move into the second bill at this time, but we wanted to get you up here to give you an opportunity to testify. We will have, obviously, another public hearing and hopefully a work session that will pass.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much.
Something like this bill, if not the bill itself. Good. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, members of the committee.
Okay, good. Okay. We are going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 180, and we are going to open a public hearing. Are we ready for Senator Brown? They're underway. Okay. Rick, if you were calling the president's
office, mm-hmm.
Oh, well, okay. But, yeah.
No, I don't believe right at
4:30. Oh, okay. I don't know.
Get the
Senator Morissette, we need to go at ease. Please.
Okay, we'll stand at ease for a few minutes. On Senate Bill 756, we did have testimony on this earlier. Dr. Bates testified before he had to leave, and so we will now hear continuing testimony. Would you please give us your name, rank, and serial number?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. State Senator Kate Brown, Senate District 21, and I just want to welcome both of my House members here with me today. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 756. As co-chair of the Oregon Women's Health and Wellness Alliance, I am happy to be here in support of this very important bill. Since I was elected to the House in 1992, I've worked very hard to make sure that all Oregonians have access to health care, regardless of their race, socioeconomic status, and, or in this case, gender. Senate Bill 756 will be a step forward in ensuring that all Oregonians have access to their basic health care services. During the 1990s, 21 states have passed legislation that forbids health insurance providers from excluding birth control coverage. Frankly, I'm not surprised. This is really basic health care for most women. And obviously, contraceptives have a proven track record of enhancing the health of women and preventing unintended pregnancies. And as most of you know, most insurance companies cover abortions. We think it makes sense to cover the prevention and contraceptives. We've been working on this for over 10 years. We think it's a basic matter of fairness. We're winning this issue in the courts nationally. We just urge you to vote yes on this bill.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, I'm State Representative Carolyn Tomei, representing Milwaukee and Southeast Portland. I'm also co-chair with Senator Brown of the Oregon Women's Health and Wellness Alliance, and this bill is part of our legislative package. I want to thank you for allowing me to testify today in favor of Senate Bill 756, which would prohibit insurance plans from excluding prescription family planning drugs and insurance benefit packages. Simply put, this bill requires that birth control be treated like any other prescription drug. This is an issue, as Senator Brown stated, of basic fairness and equity for women. Currently in Oregon, almost one-third of insured women report that their health insurance coverage does not include contraceptives. Because of these inequities, women of reproductive age pay 68% more out-of-pocket expenses for health care services than do men of the same age. Passing Senate Bill 756 will alleviate this inequality in health care costs. I cannot emphasize enough the importance of a woman's ability to decide if and when to start a family. Prescription contraception enables women to make proactive life decisions about pregnancy. As a woman and as a mother, I am a strong supporter of family planning and believe that it is crucial for all women to have access to the form of contraception that suits them best. Prescription contraception is not a perk. It is a basic health care. Women need to be able to choose when to become pregnant, space out the ages of their children, or not to become pregnant at all. This allows women to have greater control over their family finances, professional plans, and physical well-being. If common methods of prescription contraception are not affordable or accessible for Oregon women, many women will forego birth control altogether to avoid the high out-of-pocket costs. These are not decisions that Oregon women should be forced to make. By reducing the cost of contraceptives for all women, this bill will help prevent unintended pregnancies. As you know, unintended pregnancies have been associated with low birth weight, inadequate prenatal care, and other risky behaviors such as drug and alcohol use during gestation. These circumstances during pregnancy may lead to tragic and costly consequences. The cost of providing contraceptive coverage at most is minimal. For health plans that currently do not cover any method of contraception, it will cost employers $1.43 per month per employee. This increase does not take into account the cost savings from preventing pregnancies or delays in childbearing. The lack of birth control coverage costs insurers, employers, and employees thousands of dollars in lost work productivity and higher associated health care costs. In fact, the Washington Business Group on Health
estimates that failing to provide coverage for contraception costs employers 15 to 17% more than providing that coverage. Colleagues, Senate Bill 765 makes good business sense. Please vote yes on this Senate bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that. She can only hope. but right, given that I'm sitting next to my senator, perhaps that would not be a wise move. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's my great pleasure to join my colleagues today and testify in support of Senate Bill 756. I should state at the outset that I am State Representative Diane Rosenbaum, representing House District 42. This bill is about basic fairness, and it is about protecting the women of Oregon and their families and also the employers of Oregon. And in fact, you know, this is so much a common sense thing that if you stopped 10 people out on the street today and told them that we don't already have this as a requirement in law, I think most people would be quite astounded to find out that it's not already the case. And that's why I think it's just a simple solution and one that really ought to be moving forward. In fact, as the senator said, we have been waiting for over a decade, and it is past time to do this. I want to just briefly add another wrinkle to this, and that is to talk a little bit about the legal aspect of it and why this is really good for the employers of Oregon. Lawsuits, as you know, have been filed, and in every case have been decided in the same way, and it has been determined under federal law that not providing the coverage that this bill calls for is sex discrimination under the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission law and also under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. And the EEOC has consistently said that it's sex discrimination, and the federal courts have agreed, and so have the appellate courts. And that has resulted, as was stated, as in 21 states doing this, either by passing laws or, in a lot of cases, by executive order. We think that following this line of lawsuit that the employers of Oregon are at risk of being sued, and it's just not right that our employers should be having to bear the legal costs of defending against similar lawsuits when they're filed in Oregon, when we could very simply protect them from those costs and provide this basic coverage. So for all of those reasons, regardless of your views on contraception, and I think that people can generally agree about the need to prevent unintended pregnancy, it is time, it is past time for the women of Oregon, for the families of Oregon, for the employers of Oregon, to see Senate Bill 756 move out of the committee, to pass in the Senate, and to move over in the House. And I thank you very much for holding the hearing today and for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We're going to hear four more witnesses are giving testimony, and Cheryl, okay, you can go.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Cheryl Walker, would you please come up, and Carol Robinson, would you also come up, please, and then we will hear Laura Bridges and Vicki Patagona, and then we will open a work session. Welcome back.
Thank you, Senator.
We missed you.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to see all of you. Mr. Chair, thank you, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I am Cheryl Walker. I'm from Southern Oregon, Josephine County, Grants Pass specifically. It's my pleasure to be here today. I didn't know this hearing was taking place. I was here on other business today, but I am absolutely delighted that you're having this hearing today. Thank you so much. I would like to say today that the senator and the representatives that just spoke before me very eloquently outlined the necessity and the very important need of having this kind of legislation. The importance of contraceptive coverage is astounding. The information that we have in regards to health care and the prevention of unintended pregnancies is overwhelming. I would like to go on, though, and talk to you a little bit about the economics of it, as well as relate to you a little information that I carried with me when I came to this legislature and that I want to relate to you today. Nearly 60 years ago, there was a drug brought out on the market that was used to help women who had menstrual problems. These often led to other health conditions. They found a side effect of that drug was to prevent pregnancies and became known as a contraceptive drug. At that point in time, that drug was not paid for by insurance. And now here we are nearly four generations later, my granddaughter approaching puberty, and I'm thinking about her, that any insurance coverage that she would have would not cover contraception after all of these years. There are very few drugs on the market that require prescriptions that are not covered by insurance. It has been excluded. Contraceptives have been very systematically excluded, and that is unacceptable. I think that being nearly 50 years on the market, it's about time. In fact, it's past time. People who need the coverage for contraceptive are young, childbearing age women. Oftentimes, they work in lower-end jobs. They may have insurance, but they have no contraceptive coverage. They may only make a minimum wage. And if they're paying nearly $600 a year for their contraceptive supplies or pills, whatever they use, those FDA-approved product, if they're having to pay more than 2 weeks' pay in a year for those drugs, oftentimes they will forego it because their income is so low they have to pay for other health care for their children or they have to put food on the table. And they'll make that choice, often to their peril, because then they'll become pregnant, oftentimes unwanted, unplanned, and then we have the high-risk pregnancies. So the ones that are the higher risk are the ones that really need this legislation. Those of us who are more advantaged, we would like to have the coverage, but we can pay for it. And I'm talking about the middle and lower income women who cannot. And I'm here today as a voice for them. I'm not here for any particular organization. I'm here today to represent those women who cannot be here. And this is very necessary for them. And I thank you very much for the opportunity today, and I do hope that you will pass this bill out to the floor. It's very much needed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman Morissette, committee members. Thank you very much for this opportunity. My name is Carol Robinson, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Business Association. And I am proud to represent a business organization that is in support of Senate Bill 756, asking you to vote to require health service contractors and insurance that self-coverage in Oregon to include prescription birth control in their prescription prescription medication benefits package. As a business organization, OBA understands the importance of preventative health care. Preventative health care allows our members to maintain a healthy and stable workforce. But more importantly, as business leaders, we know that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and that applies to Senate Bill 756. Covering birth control pills, and you've heard the economics from Senator Brown and the state representatives who testified on this, is more cost-effective than not covering it. And I think this is the real key to this argument is can be found in the American Journal of Public Health, which compared the cost and benefits of contraceptive coverage in managed care plans provided by large employers of 45 major metropolitan areas. They found that all 15 contraceptive methods were cost-effective when compared to the direct medical cost of unintended pregnancies. But when you think about the direct and indirect cost of unintended pregnancies, including normal live births, abortions, miscarriages, ectopic pregnancies, and the surgeries that are required after that, wages and benefits for employees' absences, maternity leave, pregnancy-related sick leave, and replacing employees who do not return to work after a pregnancy, you can see that it's completely cost-effective. I won't repeat some of the testimony that's already occurred, but I do want to emphasize that when our health care committee was meeting to discuss this particular issue, one of our business members who has a very large company that employs a number of young women in their employ was not certain whether their coverage covered these contraception methods, and that kind of stunned all of us, not because he didn't know, but because of the legal risks that his company could be put under. The clarity that this bill would provide for employers and insurers will help protect businesses from litigation, which you've already heard about. And I think that's a really key point to our organization as well. So in conclusion, I just hope that Oregon will be the 22nd state to address discrimination and provide private insurance coverage for birth control. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Representative Boone, would you come up, please?
And then Vicki.
And Vicki. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to read testimony in opposition to this bill because there's everybody, all of the testimony is in support of. This is from Bob Castagna, who is representing the Catholic Oregon Catholic Conference, and I'll just read the amendment that he would like to have included in the bill. Notwithstanding any other provision of the law, the insurer of a health insurance policy may exclude prescription contraceptives if the coverage required under Section 2 of this Act is contrary to the religious tenet of the group or entity on whose behalf the health insurance policy is offered and the group or entity is operated, supervised and controlled by or in connection with the religious organization or demonstrated or denominational group or entity. Now, this is what he refers to as a conscience clause. This bill has been before the legislature since 1999 at least, and this has always been an objection, and I respect their opinion. I am a Catholic, and I respect the opinion of the Catholic Conference, but I choose not to add this amendment or hear the amendment. I will say publicly, which I would have said if they had been here, that I don't believe that institutions have a conscience. People have consciences, and so there are many institutions who object to various things, but in all due respect to my church, I don't agree with their amendment. So we will hear those of you who are here, and if we have a quorum, we will have a work session. The right makeup of a quorum, I should say. Yes, please introduce yourself.
How can I follow that one? Good afternoon, committee members. Senator Morissette. For the record, my name is Deborah Boone, State Representative, House District 32, which is the upper left coast of our state.
Upper left coast.
And the most beautiful weather in the whole state is in Seaside and Tillamook today. 2 hours you could be there. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 756. I also am here to enter into the record testimony on behalf of Cara Weber, and Barbara Fox. And I don't want to take up any more time in repeating what's already been stated because I agree with all of it except the piece that you did, Senator Morissette. And I too respect the Catholic point of view, but I agree that institutions do not have consciences, people do. And I think that in answer to the question about why we should do this, I'm all about primary prevention any way I can get it in healthcare. I think it's the best bang for our buck. And I also think that in answer to people who don't agree with some of our beliefs from some of the people here for Pro-Choice Oregon Day, by paying for birth control and having people use it, it will avoid the necessity for abortions. So that is one reason that I always say to the people I talk to who do not believe in this. In any case, I do support this bill. I hope it goes forward. I think it will save money in the long run, and it will ensure that women have equal access to prescription drug coverage, just as men do for other products that I can't imagine why we wouldn't be getting paid for. If prescription drug covers something that's a medical condition or a need, then it should be paid for, just the same as it is for women, just as it's the same it is for men. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Morissette and members of the committee. My name is Laura Bridges, and I'm the affiliate president for NARAL Pro-Choice Oregon. Most of what I was going to testify on today has already been said, and I'll let my written testimony stand for what I was going to originally speak on. But I would like to just mention that approximately one-third of Oregon women with health insurance report that their insurance policy does not include contraceptive coverage. Contraceptive equity legislation will not only increase access to birth control, but increase access to the methods that best fit with a woman's individual health concerns and lifestyles, and this will effectively prevent unintended pregnancies. Women are the most able to use contraception correctly and consistently when they can choose the method that best works for them rather than the method that they can best afford. Birth control is not a luxury for women. It is basic health care. While women are the primary beneficiaries, the benefits do extend to men, families, the communities, and the health and social service systems that share the burden of coping with unintended pregnancies. So in conclusion, I'd just like to ask for your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Morissette and members of the committee. My name is Vicki Pettigana, and I'm a registered nurse with Planned Parenthood of the Columbia Willamette. I'm here today to speak on behalf of Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon, who would like to add its voice of support to Senate Bill 756. Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon represents the two Planned Parenthood affiliates in Oregon, Planned Parenthood of the Columbia Willamette and Planned Parenthood Health Services of Southwestern Oregon. Planned Parenthood provides affordable reproductive health care services, family planning, and other medical services to thousands of men and women in 16 clinics statewide. Planned Parenthood served almost 80,000 patients in 2004. As a healthcare provider that offers family planning services, more specifically information, consultation, and prescription for contraceptive methods, we recognize the importance of providing Oregon women with the full range of prescription birth control options. Half of all pregnancies in the United States are unintended, and more than half of these pregnancies end in abortion. Contraceptions have a proven track record of enhancing the health of women, preventing unprevented pregnancy, and reducing the need for abortion. Yet the most effective forms of birth control are not accessible to many women. Lack of access to birth control carries substantial health risks to women. Not all contraceptive methods are medically appropriate for all women. When all the common methods of reversible prescription contraceptions are not available, some women, and this has been mentioned before, may choose less expensive, less appropriate methods or forego birth control altogether. And that is because they can't afford the high cost out of pocket. I have information about all kinds of different methods of hormonal and non-hormonal birth control, and I think we gave you a pamphlet on those to review. And as you can see, there are a variety of effective prescription birth control methods, and each method may not be appropriate for all women. Providing coverage for all FDA-approved contraceptive methods is essential in allowing Oregon women to be healthy and successfully plan their families. Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon, representing Planned Parenthood health care providers in Oregon, is advocating for the passage of Senate Bill 756. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we have one more person to give testimony. Michelle Gooden, would you... Oh, she's here already.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to go into a work session after this, so go ahead.
Okay. Chair Morissette and members of the committee, I really want to thank you for hearing my testimony today.
Right?
I am. My name is Michelle Gooden, and I live in Springfield. And I'm here...
I'm here.
I know. That's why I wanted to talk. I'm here as a member of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and I've also submitted written testimony for your reference. And I want to say my husband and I chose to pursue graduate degrees first and then a family because we wanted to wait until we could provide for a family. family first. But in 2003, I filed a federal complaint with the United States Equal Employment Opportunity Commission against my employer, the City of Eugene. At that time, my health insurance company refused to provide coverage for my prescription contraceptives, which I took not just to prevent an unwanted pregnancy, but also for a medical condition known as polycystic ovarian syndrome. Even with this medical condition, I was still refused coverage. And I want to note here that my insurance does cover an entire pregnancy for a mere $25 copay, vasectomies, and infertility treatment, but at the time, no prescription birth control. In 2000, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and a federal judge in Washington issued a ruling that states that any employer who will not cover prescription contraceptives in their prescription drug plans is in violation of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, specifically the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, which prohibits employers from discrimination in job benefits for women who are pregnant or might become pregnant. When she visits her doctor for a prescription contraceptive, women must be afforded the same coverage that would apply if she or any other employee had consulted a doctor for other preventative services. And I also provided a copy of that ruling with my written testimony. The EEOC ruled in my favor, and they gave my employer two choices. They could add the benefit for their employees, or they would face a lawsuit. And my employer chose to open our union contract and add that benefit for over 650 employees and their dependents, and the cost of doing so is minimal. The EEOC also assured me that any woman who files a complaint in this regard, they would rule in her favor. Unfortunately, I'm not alone on this issue. In 2000, Dow Jones and Company settled out of court for the same reason, and last year, women employees of Union Pacific Railroad filed a lawsuit for the same reason. And Walmart is also in the midst of the largest class action lawsuit in United States history due to their discrimination on the job against women employees and in part their refusal to cover prescription contraceptives in their health benefits. 21 states now have contraceptive equity laws, including California, Washington, and even Texas. Some legislation dates as far back as 1998. So I really think the bottom line is that contraception is a very real and necessary part of women's health care. It is used to prevent pregnancy and treat potentially life-threatening medical conditions. I feel this is not about abortion or emergency contraceptive. This is a totally separate issue. This is about employers who are breaking the law by practicing illegal sex discrimination. Every day that goes by that Oregon has no contraceptive equity law, the state is telling employers that this type of discrimination is okay. It is telling women that a vasectomy is an acceptable form of birth control to be paid for by insurance, but a woman who wants to take a drug that is safe, effective, and has been available for over half a century to prevent pregnancy must pay for it on her own. It is telling women that men have unrestricted access to whatever drug they might need to treat a medical condition, but that women do not. This is absurd. Like I mentioned, 21 other states have already decided that women's health is of the utmost importance. This is about assuring women that their basic health needs will be protected by the state in which they live. And Oregon is woefully behind the times. And I urge you to take a long look at Senate Bill 756, which is a bill about basic women's health, and consider the potential consequences of not having a contraceptive equity bill. Continued lawsuits, higher abortion rates, unplanned pregnancies, damaging effects on infant health, higher out-of-pocket health care costs for women, and the continued discrimination against women in the state regarding access to prescription drug benefits. Thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Michelle.
Thank you so much for hearing me. I will use
this as my floor speech.
That's right. Thank you. I really appreciate your time, all of you. Thank you so much.
Right. And you can thank Ralph for calling it.
I own one.
Okay. Others who wish to submit written testimony may do so. And at this time, we will close the public hearing. And do you want to do this?
I'll do it. What do you want me to do?
Lori's
there. No, I thought this was weird.
I'm sorry.
Just open a work session.
Yeah, okay. Okay, I'm closing the public hearing, and we are going to open the work session on Senate Bill 756.
Chair Morissette, yes. I move Senate Bill 756 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Monsanderson moves Senate Bill 756 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Seeing no discussion, would the clerk call the roll, please?
Vice Chair Curtis?
No.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Maud Sanderson?
Aye.
Senator Charles Starr?
No.
Chair Morissette?
Aye. Thank you. Having received the Congress majority, the bill passes, and I will ask Dr. Senator Alan Bates to carry the bill.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
I would like to serve notice of a possible minority report.
Very good. So noted.
Kate Brown, does it want to carry?
You're up.
Okay. We'll check.
Yeah, he was saying,
come on, what a big club.
It is adjourned.
Right. I want to find out.